This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
And welcome to the People Speak Radio. This is your host, David Swanson, and we are very privileged. We've been waiting a long time to have the guest we have for the next hour, congressional candidate, Democratic candidate from Missouri's 2nd District, Byron DeLeer. Byron is someone I've heard a lot of good things about from a lot of friends and read good things about from people, including Gore Vidal. And he has a website. You can check him out. It's DeLeerForCongress.org. That's D-E-L-E-A-R. D-E-L-E-A-R, DeLeerForCongress.org. He is running in Missouri's 2nd District as a Democrat against an incumbent Republican by the name of Todd Akin. Byron DeLeer, thanks for being on the People Speak Radio.
David Swanson, thank you so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. We've heard a lot about you and want to find out where you stand on some of the issues in the news right now and how things are going in your campaign. Now, do you have a primary coming up?
Yes, we do have a contested primary. We got a whole basketball team worth of individuals running for, five folks running for the primary, and we have been fortunate to receive a ton of local endorsements and are doing very well in our fundraising and building the kind of effective campaign machinery that is absolutely so necessary in taking on an entrenched Republican like Representative Akin. So we're looking forward to taking our arguments on to the general election and turning this district blue come November.
Now if you defeat your adversaries in the primary, do you expect that they will drop out or keep the campaign going in hopes that you might get sick or something?
You mean kind of like, you know, I think Hillary was meeting with the Supreme Court the other day. You know, she wanted to bring on some of that year 2000 Florida stuff in regard to her presidential campaign right now.
Oh, my goodness.
No, I suspect that if I win the primary primary fellow Democrats that I'm competing with will rally behind our effort to get rid of, frankly, one of the most extreme Bush Republicans, radical legislators in the U.S. House, Representative Akin. There's only a handful of legislators that would be considered more radical than Todd Akin. And so, frankly, in some ways, he's kind of an embarrassment for Missouri. He does have some honorable traits. For example, he's got a son who is actually serving in the Marines and serving in Iraq. But so you can't fault a family for showing up for service in that regard. But Representative Akin has been supporting the Bush agenda lock, stock, and barrel. And he's been voting to deny children health care. He's been voting to block regulating the out-of-control subprime mortgage industry. He's been introducing legislation to dismantle the separation of church and state while our country's economically on fire. I mean, it's absolutely not just a case of ineptitude. We're talking frank dereliction of duty and being absent-mindedly unaware of what the true needs of the folks here in the 2nd District of Missouri are, or more importantly, our nation as a whole. I mean, to be doing this religious cha-cha on the deck of the Titanic while we're facing one of the worst recessions in 100 years is just unconscionable.
How long has he been in there?
He came into office along with Bush in 2001, January is when he was sworn in.
So he's a real Bush Congress member.
Yeah, and Bush is a four-letter word, and Akin is a four-letter word. So
there you go. So let me, before we get into exactly how you differ from Congressman Akin, let me tell people how they can get in on this conversation with future Congressmember Byron DeLeer from Missouri's 2nd District. You can call in toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada, 888 888- 888-228-4494. Anywhere else in the world, join us toll free, 877-489-6350, 877-489-6350, or go to thepeoplespeakradio.net and go to the chat room and send in your questions and we will ask them. So, Byron, I can't help but turn to the topic of Iraq. I'm here on Capitol Hill, and we found out not too many minutes back that they're not going to vote this week. We thought they were going to vote again this week on yet another pile of money to extend the occupation of Iraq. But apparently the Blue Dog Democrats, the conservative right-wing Democrats, are concerned about spending money on veterans' education when they're busy recklessly wasting money on a foreign occupation. And so they're trying to figure things out, bring it up next week. If you were in Congress, what would your position be on
I would absolutely force a constitutional crisis and put George Bush's hands to the fire of his failed dereliction of duty in regard to the worst foreign policy conducted by our country in decades, which is the tragedy unfolding in Iraq. The United States House of Representatives has the power of the purse, and I think that a little courage needs to be evidenced from some legislators that see 70%, 80% of the American people opposed to this war in Iraq. We know that it was ill-conceived, mismanaged, bungled, that deceptions were put forth to justify the invasion and occupation of Iraq, and I think it's the duty of the Democrats that are in the House to fall on their political sword a little bit, if you will, and force a constitutional crisis, because I think the only reason why we're perpetuating this madness right now is in some sort of a way to save a legacy of a lame duck Bush White House. And that is no reason to continue to bleed out the integrity and reputation and stature of the United States in the international community. It's no reason to continue to put our American men and service women in harm's way, and not to mention the millions and millions upon folks that have been shut out of their place where they live, and they're put into refugee status. The fact that we're financing both sides of a civil war over there, I mean, it's not a tenable situation, and we need to stop the bleeding. We need to withdraw our troops from Iraq. I would not fund it.
I couldn't ask for a better answer. Of course, there are quite a few members of Congress now who say that, in theory anyway, they're opposed to the funding. In fact, a few weeks ago, 147 Democrats and 2 Republicans voted no on the funding in the House, which combined with a bunch of Republicans voting present was enough to block it. But if they manage to buy off the Blue Dog Democrats somehow and bring this up as one vote on both this massive amount of money for Iraq and a little bit of money for education for veterans, we are likely to see quite a few Congress members say, well, you know, I'd like to end the war, but I can't vote against education for veterans, even though the two things could be done as completely separate bills.
That is the solution, David. I mean, you and I both know that we need to parse out some of these completely separate issues so that we get a thumb up or thumb down from our representatives to create a more open source democracy, an open source government. We need to know what our representatives stand for and what they don't stand for. And so to add these confusing, disparate issues into one bill to railroad through the perpetuation of this madness is a dysfunction in our federal government. And that's why parsing out these different issues needs to happen in the context of legislative reform. Sorry to interrupt you.
please interrupt at any time. I love everything you're saying. But of course, an individual Congress member doesn't always have control over what the leadership does, even if it's the same party. Is it safe to assume that you would vote no on war money, even if they put some good things in the same bill?
You know, the big 800-pound gorilla in the room is the $3 trillion projection for the cost of the Iraq war, not to mention the trillions of dollars of damage to the reputation of the United States in the international community. I mean, it's a hard thing to quantify. It's definitely billions and billions, if not trillions of dollars of damage. And so what does that figure politically start to equate to? I mean, you've got $3 million that Joseph Stiglitz projects the war to be, and that may seem like a large figure, but I know you're aware of this, David. One of the things that Stiglitz was mentioning as he was forwarding this new book that he's written is that the peak payments to World War II veterans, the peak payouts to World War II veterans occurred in 1993. So you know from that statistic that this Iraq war is going to be paid for 50 or 60 years from now. And that's where they start to get this $3 trillion figure. But when you consider the political damage it has done to the United States, this is like a $6 trillion figure or something. So I don't think it's sensible for a blue dog who's interested in fiscal responsibility as their principal tenet, I don't think it's reasonable for them to continue that kind of out-of-control fiscal policy, because it's truly bankrupting our nation. And if you're a student of history, which I know you are, we're seeing the American empire march in the footsteps of the empires of the past, overextending itself militarily, overextending itself economically, bleeding out the true heart and soul economic interests in the center of our country to the select moneyed interests that are manipulating our corridors of power. This happened in the Roman Empire, it happens in the British Empire, and it's happening right now in the American Empire. So shutting down the kind of out-of-control foreign policy that the Bush administration has foisted upon the American people and upon the people of the world would be number one in terms of an agenda for fiscal responsibility. So I would make the argument to the blue dogs that they need to really face balance. They need to reconcile their national checkbook to those statistics.
I got to tell you, I'm having doubts about you as a candidate for Congress, because I understand there's an opening for a vice presidential candidate. This is what we need in this town, and we don't have enough of it. We have a progressive caucus that doesn't push these progressive positions hard enough. And I love that you use the phrase constitutional crisis, because my impression is that one of the major motivations for keeping the funding going is the understanding that if they stop the funding, the president will simply misappropriate funds from elsewhere to keep the occupation in place. And should that happen, it becomes that much harder. I mean, anything's possible, but it becomes that much harder to avoid the I word, impeachment. Needless to say, there have been impeachable offenses committed already. Almost everyone here on this Hill agrees with that. It's just there's just disagreement on whether they should actually impeach him for them. What's your take on that?
You know, I've been on public record in supporting impeachment, and it's not coming from a partisan agenda as much as setting standards for future administrations, because we've seen a gross negligence to the rule of law and direct violations of the simple language of the Constitution, rendering 6/10 of our Bill of Rights superfluous in regard to unwarranted spying on Americans, or the euphemisms to justify torture, or the kind of signing statements that the American Bar Association indicted as being a violation of the separation of powers. We've seen a really basic assault on our fundamental American form of government. And so the agenda to me, David, is not to vilify or demonize George Bush or do little caricatures with horns coming out of his heads or anything like this. The idea is to set standards for future administrations. We are a nation of laws. We are a nation of checks and balances. The power to wage war should never reside on the shoulders of one man. And any executive that fancies himself or herself to be king needs to be put in check. And that's what the mechanism of impeachment was designed to do. I think that Nancy Pelosi did a great disservice by saying that impeachment was off the table, because she removed that metaphorical sword of Damocles that needs to be hanging over the executive that is wielding the most powerful destructive military arsenal ever assembled in the history of humanity. Great restraint and responsibility and accountability needs to reside with that power. And that's why impeachment mentioned six times in the Constitution is in there. And so now we do have to backpedal a little bit here, because I guess you could make the argument that maybe Nancy Pelosi was putting politics over principle a little bit by saying impeachment was off the table, because what happened was is they maintained this amazing gross level of dissatisfaction with the Bush administration giving itself more rope to hang itself more with continually after the 06 election cycle. And you could make the argument from a sort of a detached, dispassionate historical perspective, you could make the argument that the Obama movement has filled that vacuum. So in some ways, this amazing candidacy and electoral machine writing new history books for our nation in the form of the Obama presidency and nomination of the Democratic Party. You know, the other side of that coin is the tragedy of the Bush disaster that made that possible. And so, you know, we have to be honest with ourselves. You know, maybe in some ways Nancy Pelosi had a mirror of magic that she was looking into, prognosticating into the future, because certainly I'm very hopeful in my support of Barack Obama and lifting him up in every interview I do. I think that he represents an amazing restorative tool for America's integrity in the international community, and I have high hopes for his presidency.
Well, I do too, but then there's the question of who comes 4 years later and 8 years later and 12 years later. And as you've said, if we don't establish the precedent that presidents and vice presidents have to obey laws, what are we letting ourselves in for? Because, you know, the political argument that I think you're right about with Pelosi and others in the leadership is arguably questionable on its own terms, right? I mean, when they went after Nixon, then they won. When they let Reagan go because they were making this same exact calculation, they then lost big. And so you look back through history and the case seems to point the other way. But even assuming it's right, why risk, you know, not just a President John McCain, but a President John McCain or a President Obama with all of these powers? There was a story today that Senator McCain has made clear that he would reserve for himself as president the right to engage in illegal and unconstitutional warrantless spying, the same as the current president. That to me is something that we shouldn't have to fend off with an election. That should be off the table, regardless of who we elect next.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Those sanctioning of torture, the slow removal of civil liberties and hard-fought-for protections should never be codified into law. And certainly I can understand from an executive point of view that he or she must reserve they must do what they think is right to protect the interests of the American people. But as soon as you start setting up these institutions where we start to, on a very basic level, transform our form of government, that's where America ceases to be America anymore. And we are an evolving struggle and evolving experiment. And it's time for folks that see the big picture to get engaged, to press in. If you hear a candidate talking about America in terms of this sacrosanct body of politic that represents people and living interests and sustainability, if you hear a candidate talking about those things and it sounds like something new, you know, speaking to the audience right now, press in. You know, send them an email, volunteer for them, make phone calls. I mean, we really can pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps and get our nation righting our ship of state. We really can get this done. It's going to take folks that care, that want to be engaged and want to be involved. I mean, that's why I'm running for office. That's why I'm standing up to be counted. I completely sacrificed my entire life I had a successful career in media and the entertainment industry in Los Angeles, and I wound up selling my house in Sherman Oaks and founding a nonprofit organization after 9/11 and flying to the Middle East and started working on conflict resolution in Israel, Palestine, and Egypt. So I've changed my life, and I know that many Americans are doing the same. And we can protect our country from destroying itself and from imploding upon itself. And I think, David, that you are an amazing steward to the information and communications revolution, and I've really appreciated the leadership that you've expressed in being a soldier of truth. Not a soldier in the old mold, but a soldier of truth, the new soldier of the 21st century. And so I'm very, very honored to be on your show.
Well, thank you. I hope the new soldier of the 21st century is a nonviolent soldier. That would be a wonderful thing. We are speaking with future Congress member Byron DeLeer from Missouri's 2nd District, running as a Democrat in the upcoming primary and then the general election against Republican incumbent Todd Akin. And you do not have to live in Missouri's 2nd District to get involved or to contribute financially and otherwise. You can go to DeLeerForCongress.org. D-E-L-E-A-R, DeLeerForCongress.org. And we have questions coming in by email, but I want to remind people that they can get in on this conversation by telephone at 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. That's toll-free. And outside the U.S. and Canada, 877-489-6350. Here's a question from Larry in Wisconsin. I saw your bio on the People Speak website. You really are involved internationally regarding Israel-Palestine. Can you speak about that ongoing effort?
You know, I founded a nonprofit organization with a gentleman named Ofer Lifshitz, who was living in Southern California at the time, and he was an Israeli native, and we founded this Global Peace Solution and sponsored a delegation to the Middle East and met with high-level leadership in the Israeli government, the Palestinian Authority. I met with the head of the Arab Democratic Party, a gentleman named Abdul Wahab Derwashi, and we met with different Knesset members. We eventually aligned our efforts with a group called MIFCOD, which means consensus, or the transliteration would be people's voice. And MIFCOD was forwarding a 6-point peace plan that was basically a simplification of the Geneva Accord, calling for a two-state solution, two states living side by side in peace. Now, we've heard this rhetoric over the years so often repeated ad nauseum about this two-state solution, and yet we never see it materialize. We never see it emerge. But what this group was doing that seemed unique to me was, we had a representative of the Palestinian contingent. His name was Seri Nusebe, and he was the dean of the Al-Quds University in Jerusalem, which is Al-Quds is the word is the word in Arabic for holy, which is what they refer to Jerusalem as being. And he represented the Palestinian side, and it was only representing the interests of the Palestinians. And then we had on the Israeli side a gentleman named Ami Ayalon. Now, Ami Ayalon was a gentleman that was a retired rear admiral from the Israeli Navy and the ex-head of Shin Bet. So his credentials in terms of supporting the interests of Israel were unassailable. So we had these two leaders from both sides, and they came together to author what was called the Ayalon Nusebe Initiative, which was a very simplified version of the Geneva Accord. And what I helped popularize and helped work on with Global Peace Solution, aligning our efforts, being the North American representative for MIFCOD, was the popularization of this mandate, and it garnered 500,000 signatories of Palestinians and Israelis in a region of about 6 to 7 million folks. And what was particularly moving was seeing folks that had actually suffered, families that had suffered due to the Intifada, either Israeli families losing their children to suicide bombers or Palestinian families losing kids because of some particular Israeli military incursion into the West Bank or Gaza and killing people. And these grieved parents were pressing into MIFCOD, and they were helping popularize the call for peace. And if we can learn from anybody, we should definitely learn from folks that have suffered the worst due to these tragic conflicts. And part of the idea here is that a successful narrative for conflict resolution will be built on the common need for safety. That our children need to be safe. Palestinian children need to be safe. Israeli children need to be safe. And if you can build a successful narrative from those common human needs, then that is where we can arrive at a solution. Now, let me be a cynic for a moment. We have some of the worst warmongers around, and yes, I'll use the word warmonger, folks like George Bush and Condoleezza Rice and Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz, all talking about a two-state solution. And then you got, in addition to that, you've got Prime Minister Ehud Olmert saying things like, for Israel's survival to be secure, we must arrive at a two-state solution. And then you have 60 to 70% of both the Israeli population and the Palestinian population both desiring desperately an acceptable solution to both sides. So how is it, in that spectrum of possibility and undeniable desire for peace and an acceptable solution, that we don't see it happen? And it just makes you realize that, like in many other conflicts around the face of the earth, unfortunately, there are a select few that profit off of a perpetuated sense of conflict, a perpetuated sense of war, eternal war. And we need to call those people out. And we need to say, look, if you really believe in a two-state solution, then we need a complete package right now. If I was president of the United States, I wouldn't go to the Knesset and give some speech about appeasing and about Iran and all this kind of stuff just to pander to the legislators in the parliament of Israel. I would go there and say, America guarantees the security of Israel. But to guarantee a secure and peaceful future for both our nations, we must guarantee safety for Palestinians. We must arrive at this peace solution. We must arrive at it with all due diligence, and it must be a complete package. And there will be bumps along the way. There will be people that try to shut this peace process down. But we must persevere and push through that and give these people the dignity and justice that they deserve.
I can't imagine a wiser, more sensible, more common sense and pragmatic approach, but it's so far from what happens here inside the Beltway. We've got to go to a break, but I want to ask you, because there seems to be an understanding here in Washington that there's no gap between the opinions and the policy desires of Jews in America, the people of Israel, the Israeli government, and AIPAC, the American Israeli Political Action Committee, if I've got that right, which of course has had a big conference this past week. And what is your impression in terms of how well AIPAC and the Israeli government represent the wishes of the people of Israel?
You know, I think that my politics began in Israel. I'm a neophyte at this political mission that I've taken upon myself. I've been doing this for 5 years, and my politics began there. I met with members of the Knesset before I met with local legislative leaders here in the States. So, I've been from Dan to Eilat, you know, from top to bottom. I met with, and my partner, Ofer Lifshitz, now in Global Peace Solution. He is the chairman of an Israeli political party called Brit Olam, which means Eternal Covenant. It's a progressive political party in Israel, and I'm sure he's going to be taking place in these elections coming up soon. And so I kind of have an intimate relationship with Israel, a romantic relationship with Palestine and Israel. And I hopefully, in interfacing with folks in the Jewish community here, I think that they get a sense that that I care about the future of the Middle East, and that I'm not, you know, entertaining some sort of apocalyptic agenda to have some sort of overhyped, militarized, Likudnik kind of a perspective. Because just as much as our overhyped, militarized agenda in Iraq has failed the United States miserably, both in loss of human life, loss of reputation, and loss of precious treasure and fiscal weight in Iraq, you can see how the same kind of overhyped, militarized response to what had occurred with Syria was like a miniaturized version of the Iraq occupation, and you saw Israeli Israeli troops retreat right out of there. They couldn't stay in theater because they had the smarts to pull out. So I think that there is just as much value in a successful defense portfolio to reduce motivations for conflict as there are to meet force with force alone. In other words, you can get attacked and you can respond with force, which is an appropriate response. You can meet fire with fire. You can fight fire with fire. But you also can fight fire with water. You can quench motivations for conflict. And this is really the balanced defense portfolio of a reasonable, restrained, and practical military doctrine that doesn't get you into positions of vulnerability that then destroy opportunities for safety and peace to be delivered to citizens of both sides of any particular conflict equation. And that's where we've seen the United States get out of whack. You know, Bush has crowded the arrows of war into both our eagle's talons and into the eagle's beak. You know, we have a presidential seal that has an eagle with two talons, and one talon has an olive branch of peace, and the other talon has arrows of war. And the eagle is leaning and facing towards the olive branch of peace. And I know this is corny symbolism, but there's a purpose for this symbolism. And to go against it is to be going against what we're supposed to set up to be, which is a nation that has a great sense of equanimity, that we have a great sense of poise under friction and violence. And so I see the key to Middle East peace to be blending a reduction of motivations for conflict along with the traditional accoutrements of defense strategy.
Let's bring a caller in on this conversation with congressional candidate from Missouri's 2nd District, Byron DeLeer. We have Basima from Michigan on the line. Thanks for calling the People Speak Radio.
Thank you, David, and thank you for hosting the show. Obama said today we should never seek to dictate what is best for the Israelis and their security interests. No Israeli prime minister should ever feel dragged or blocked from the negotiating table of the United States. But by our support, financial and in every other sense of the word, including it becoming an issue in the presidential primaries, aren't we doing exactly that, future congressman? Isn't that exactly what we're doing when we are presenting the Israelis with every reasonable methodology, from monetary to military weapons, in continuing the conflict? Isn't that exactly what we're doing, forcing them onto a table of war?
Yeah, you're using the traditional debatorial technique of reductio ad absurdum, aren't you? You're reducing those statements to absurdity by turning them on their head. And
they are absurd.
I see the wisdom in what you're saying right now. We are absolutely mixed up in the perpetuation of a tragic impasse. You've got two populations that feel like their backs are against the wall. The Israelis feel like their backs are against the wall in the community of Arabic nations, and the Palestinians are backs against the wall because they're catching all sorts of hell all the time. And, you know, we are absolutely involved in this equation, and we are responsible. We are absolutely responsible. And in that, we need to be engaged and press in and not make these sort of ideological tenets or axioms that we will never cross this line or we will never do this. No, we need to deliver safety. One life lost in the West Bank or in Gaza is one life too many. And we need to pursue the ending of that hot war should be our primary agenda over there. It shouldn't be laying out some pandering to this group or some justification for this or some sort of, you know, preemptive doctrine here or there. It's not about doctrine. It's not about ideology. It's about sanity. It's about stopping the hot war. And if that means separating the warring parties so that an environment of reconciliation can start to emerge, then so be it.
We need to take a break and come back in a few minutes. When we return, you can get in on this conversation toll-free, 888-228-4494, or by going to thepeoplespeakradio.net, and you can ask this congressional candidate about any topic whatsoever. Doesn't have to be Iraq or Israel, and we hope to get to some more when we return right after this.
This is Gore Vidal. Can you name the one country on earth where the government can steal elections, strip away basic rights, spy on civilians, launch wars based on lies, and where the people do not take over the nation's capital in protest? If you said the United States, you'd be right. So let's remedy that by calling our Congress members and asking them to support the impeachment of George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by After Downing Street.
More than 1 million children are forced into prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. The economic difficulties contribute to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime, to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit sosmorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
This land is yours.
Join us on the People Speak Radio Show every Tuesday and Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern for an hour of live interview and audience interaction with guests from the realms of entertainment, education, activism, spirituality, politics, and literature. Get involved and make a difference for the better. That's the People Speak every Tuesday and Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio Network.
Maybe you and me.
And we are back at the People Speak Radio at thepeoplespeakradio.net. You can call in toll free at 888-228-4494. We are speaking with future, we hope, Congressmember Byron DeLeer from Missouri's 2nd District, and you can check him out and support him at DeLeerForCongress.org. And we were speaking off the air about these distinctions between blue dog Democrats who are very passionate about not wasting money unless it's for wars and progressive Democrats who theoretically are passionate about the things that a majority of Americans are passionate about, jobs and income and housing and health care and peace and so forth, but they don't seem to ever stand up, at least not as a unified force, and demand things the way that the blue dogs do. And you had an interesting response to what category you'd put yourself in,
yeah,
Byron.
You know, David, I kind of consider myself a blue dog progressive Democrat, and it's kind of a bit of political rhetoric. But essentially, the only caucus in Washington right now that's talking about fiscal responsibility or is actually trying to see fiscal responsibility and restraint are the blue dogs. Now, obviously, that may seem sort of shocking because I know the Republicans fancy themselves to be fiscally responsible, but certainly when you consider the national debt rising to levels never seen before and the $2 billion a day trade deficit, you know, there's no sense of imagination that would indicate that the Republicans are fiscally responsible anymore. They've foregone their ability to talk about themselves in that way. So the Blue Dogs are the only caucus that are talking about fiscal responsibility. And I see the necessity of a balanced budget amendment to the U.S. Constitution as being part of a contract with our country to make sure that we don't overextend ourselves economically and continue this war on the middle class and continue this kind of gamesmanship in Washington, D.C. that lets lobbyists manipulate policy and mangle policy and having the legislators and the executive branch buy more debt products from the actual people that are donating money to their campaigns, presenting a clear case for conflict of interest. So as a Blue Dog progressive Democrat, I support fiscal responsibility. I support a balanced budget amendment to the U.S. Constitution. But as a progressive Democrat, I do not roll over to this notion of free trade, which is kind of a doctrine about market populism and neoliberal kind of economic policies that Reagan sort of started in the 80s, making big government bad, and so that the big government should not operate in any regulatory capacity to steward to our economy or to help guide corporate agendas stateside so that they don't become unbalanced. You know, this is what free trade has destroyed. And free trade is operating as a direct assault against the middle class. We have the shipping of good American manufacturing jobs overseas, which is harmful to our country. We have the United States addicted to buying consumer products made in factories that do not have environmental standards, that operate with questionable labor practices, sometimes slave labor and child labor in many cases. And so what does that say about our respect for hard-fought-for values? If we have fought so hard for minimum wage and a 40-hour work week and the right for workers to collectively bargain and to organize and for safety in the workplace, if we fought so hard for that and yet we're so willing to just say, hey, you know what, it's okay to shut down a good American manufacturing jobs because we can get our little cheap widgets, we can get them cheaper here by having 80% of the products at Walmart made in China or made overseas. And so we have to restore values to Washington, the values of protecting the environment, because the environment that those factories are destroying overseas doesn't stay over there.
So would you support ending NAFTA and similar corporate
Absolutely.
Trade agreements?
Absolutely. I mean, I would go full-fledged, hardcore right into NAFTA. I mean, when NAFTA was signed into law in 1994, we had a $1.3 billion trade surplus with Mexico, one of our trading partners in NAFTA. Fast forward 10 years later, and that trade surplus has turned into a $45 billion trade deficit. In this case, simple numbers speak for themselves. That's where I see some of the core driving principles of the Blue Dogs as being laudable. And so, as a Blue Dog progressive Democrat, I'm attempting to frame a new political doctrine here that is about fiscal responsibility and about federal spending restraint on one hand, but on the other hand, I support fair trade agreements that have workers' rights and environmental standards. There's a bill that's been brought forth by Senator Dorgan, Senator Casey, and Senator Brown in the Senate, S-2611. That's called the Benchmarks Accountability Act. And what that does is that it creates a performance metric and a measurement system, a benchmark measurement system, to be piggybacked onto every single trade agreement that we signed. And in this case, that would be the solution. That would be the long-term, practical, sensible solution. Because when they sold NAFTA into being and they finally got Bill Clinton to sign it into law, they said that it was going to be a great boon to our economy, that it was going to create American jobs, it was going to create fiscal solvency in our country, and the opposite happened. if this Benchmarks and Accountability Act had been attached to NAFTA, it would act as a stop-loss mechanism, and it would shut down the trade agreement because it didn't satisfy what it was being sold into that it was going to accomplish. You know, if it didn't qualify, if it didn't meet the expectations of the arguments that were brought forth to bring it into being, then it gets shut down. And that's what we need to have. That's a practical position.
We have very few minutes left in this interview that's just flying by. I would add that had NAFTA been a tremendous success for the United States, but done the damage that it's done to Mexico, I still wouldn't like it. But we have a lot of people asking in the chat room at the People Speak Radio exactly what is a Blue Dog Democrat. And so let me try a definition, and then you correct me. But the Blue Dogs are a caucus within the Democratic Party here in Congress, and as we've discussed, their central concern is balancing the budget and being fiscally responsible and not wasting money, unless you're wasting that money by borrowing from China to pay for military and wars. And so when you talk about money in Washington today, at least until we get a better Congress with members like yourself, it's absolutely forbidden to point out that wars cost money and the Pentagon costs money and half of every tax dollar now goes to the military and wars. And if you're going to be a progressive, if you're going to pay for schools or green energy or jobs or anything of the sort, you're going to have to either stop dumping all of our money into the military or start taxing corporations or wealthy people or perhaps pollution or something to raise money. There has to be a change somewhere.
Sure.
Is that fair, or am I being unfair to the Blue Dogs?
Yeah, you know, I think perhaps the central organizing principle of the Blue Dogs is fiscal conservatism, and if they happen to on occasion march in lockstep with a militarized agenda or supporting wars and stuff, I don't necessarily think that that's central to their blue dogness.
Okay.
At least I'd like to make that argument that they don't have to do that, and certainly I wouldn't be doing that as a blue dog progressive Democrat. You know, the idea that we are continually financing our defense and Pentagon just so that we can protect shipping lanes for quality crude from the Middle East to keep feeding our economy. The real 21st century long-term solution is for us to make our energy independence a function of national security and sovereign integrity. And here's the win-win-win scenario that I'm discussing in my campaign. We reduce our overdependence on foreign oil by creating a renewable energy infrastructure in the United States, by designing a new economy, a green economy that is not addicted to fossil fuels. So we positively impact our foreign policy. This is win number one. We positively impact our foreign policy because we're not having to be forced to guard quality crude in the Middle East incessantly and having our whole foreign policy orbit around that agenda. So that's win number one. Win number two, we reduce our carbon emissions substantively, so we're not exacerbating global climate change and increasing global warming with the continued expulsion of this gaseous magnifying glass up into the heavens that's amplifying the heat of the sun and burning our planet up. So we positively impact global warming and the environment. And then number three, we create a sizably self-sufficient domestic manufacturing base, which reinvigorates the domestic manufacturing base here in America by the creation of green-collar jobs. And we pursue this with the same urgency that the New Deal was in FDR or the Marshall Plan after World War II or the Apollo program to send the first man to the moon. And this needs to be the new mandate of the 21st century. And this is, I think, the new Democratic doctrine that we're going to be pushing.
I am thrilled to hear it, and we are out of time, sadly. But we have been speaking with, we hope, future Congressman Byron DeLeer from Missouri's 2nd District, which I'm if I'm not mistaken, is near St. Louis or north of there, and you can check him out and learn more and get involved and support and contribute to what is perhaps the biggest contrast in a congressional campaign we have going across the country, a real Bush Republican incumbent challenged by a serious progressive Democrat. Go to DeLeerForCongress.org, D-E-L-E-A-R, DeLeerForCongress.org. Byron, thanks so much for being on the program.
David Swanson, thank you so much, and continue to do what you do. I look forward to having a cup of coffee with you up in D.C. January 2009.
I'm buying if that's not a violation of ethics rules. Thank you, Byron DeLeer. This has been David Swanson on The People Speak Radio. Go to thepeoplespeakradio.net. Contribute to us what you have left after supporting the congressional candidates of your choice. We need your money to put on this program. Tomorrow night, my guest will be well-known and much-achieved former prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi, who is the author of a new book called The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. Should be a good topic. Speak with you then.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea by the relief of the fast, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours, land. This land from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.
Touch me.